I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Kathleen Sharp. She's an award-winning journalist for the New York Times and many other publications, and her new book is Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
So this book is what one might call a true crime story or a legal thriller. It's about the pharmaceutical industry and the effects of that industry on the rest of us. It's about a drug called Procrit. What is this drug? For what purpose was it developed and approved?
Well, this was one of the first biotech blockbusters, and its generic name is EPO, and it comes in many different brands, but the biggest brands were Procrit, Epogen, and Aranesp. And all this drug does, really, is help your body multiply your own red blood cells. So it's an anti-anemia drug that doesn't pretend to cure anything, but helps people going through chemotherapy treatments or dialysis to sort of buff up their blood cells so they can endure these treatments.
So you start the book with a grisly story in great detail about the death of a man who had earlier that day been given a very large dose of Procrit. How was this drug's safety evaluated in the first place?
Well, that's a great question because it really never was evaluated adequately. This drug was a very exciting sort of breakthrough during the biotech days of the 80s. And the FDA's blood division, not its drug division, approved it under, a lot of pressure actually from Amgen. But as time went on, there were signals that this drug was actually hurting people. And some of the first signals surfaced in Europe, where bicyclists would shoot up EPO into their system to try and rev up their red blood cells and get oxygenated blood, which would give them tons of energy to climb those alpine hills. But then when those athletes started dropping dead or having heart attacks, that should have been a big red flag, and it wasn't. Even so, the FDA asked several times of Johnson & Johnson and Amgen to test the drug at approved levels in large patient pools. They asked in 93, in 96, in 98, in 2000, and even to this day, neither of the companies have adequately tested this drug.
It seems amazing that a drug like that can slip through the cracks. What is it about the FDA that allows that to happen?
Well, God bless the FDA. What you're looking at is an understaffed and sort of unrespected, regulator. And what we saw in the 90s and especially in the early 2000s is that a lot of the pharmaceutical people, the defense counsel or people who had worked in the industries were suddenly inside the FDA approving all the warning letters that went out, for example, to Johnson & Johnson and Amgen. There's this wonderful character that I found while researching this book by the name of Daniel Troy, and he had defended pharmaceuticals off K Street before he became the top lawyer inside the FDA. So while the staff was writing letters telling Johnson & Johnson to stop promoting its drug off-label or to stop running these wonderful commercials showing that EPO is great for curing fatigue, the attorney, Daniel Troy, was pretty much throwing out these letters and not letting them go through.
Is the drug, in your view, in fact safe and effective at the approved low doses?
Well, we don't know that, but what we do know is that in all of the studies that have been done over the years, about 17% of the patients die from this drug. That is, they suffer heart attacks or have other mishaps happen to them. And this is because the blood gets so thick, the red blood cells multiply so much, that it's really hard for the heart to pump your sludge through your veins. The blood turns that thick. And so so many people were dying mysteriously and unaccounted for during the marketing trials that the companies had. And it took quite a while for this to bubble up into the larger medical community. And even now, the FDA, I guess just a few months ago, warned everyone that they should do everything they can to stay off of this drug Yet here it is still on the market, and Medicare and Medicaid is still paying for it.
When a drug comes to market, it's then sold by sales representatives who, as your book reveals, play a terrifyingly large role in the practice of medicine, terrifying given that they're completely untrained for anything except selling, basically. So let's talk about Mark Duxbury. He's the subject of your book. He's the whistleblower. He was a gung-ho salesman for this drug, Procrit. What kind of pressure was he under to sell the product, and how did he go about doing it?
Well, Mark was a very charming, affable guy. He had always wanted to be a doctor, and he was pretty brilliant in many ways. And the thing we need to remember about both Mark and Dean McClellan, his best friend, was that they really believed in this drug. They really believed they were helping patients, and they believed in their boss, Johnson & Johnson, who, after all, is the most or one of the most admired companies in the world. So for several years, you know, they went along and did exactly as they were told, and how to sell the drug. And yet there were a few things that popped up that made Mark very uncomfortable. For example, he was giving free vials of this drug to doctors who then would turn around and bill it to Medicare. And at one point it became so blatant that Mark went to his boss and said, "Hey, isn't this fraud? You know, we're giving these guys free drugs, and we know that they're billing, making a false claim to Medicare." And his boss taught him to respond in a plausible deniability way. In other words, you know, what the doctors do with the drug and with their billing records is up to them. All you're doing is giving them the drug. So Mark didn't feel very comfortable with this, but he was taught sort of to look the other way. But things got so awful that at one point Mark realized that Johnson & Johnson was cheating by undercutting the real price of the drug and by reporting the price of the drug in a certain way that was a high sticker price while actually selling it at a low discount. And, of course, you know, insurance people like you and I were paying for it, or insurance companies, including Medicare and Medicaid. So when that began to happen, he started to object, and his voice grew louder and louder until he became a real pain in the neck to his bosses.
And we'll continue with Mark's story in just a moment, but let's stay with this whole Medicare scandal. This is not just about Procrit. This is about a whole practice within medicine where pharmaceutical companies offer steep discounts to doctors who are using this drug, and then they go ahead and bill insurance and Medicare at full or wholesale prices and pocket the money. That is a big problem in the United States. Do you have a sense of how much is coming out of taxpayers and insurance premium payers' pockets?
Yeah, it is a huge problem in the American healthcare system, and there's estimates that, for example, Medicare and Medicaid, they amount to about $1 trillion. So at least 10% of that is fraud and waste. And many people have said the amount of money that's fraud is as high as $250 billion a year. Now, that's money that comes out of our pocket in the way of co-pays, in the way of insurance premiums, and also through our taxes. The amount of fraud and waste that's estimated to be in our entire healthcare system is even higher. But as Dean McClellan, who is a Tucson resident, told me during the reporting of this, he could point to all of his clients, oncologists, who became millionaires as a result of this drug. So it's almost like we're subsidizing the private practice of oncologists and the private healthcare chains and even insurance companies. So, you know, I think the solution to this is to wipe out this huge layer of middlemen and to really discourage the profit at the expense of patients and go with a single-payer system.
Help us understand this more. If these oncologists were becoming millionaires basically through kickbacks, bribes, whatever you want to call them, rebates from the drug companies were selling their drugs at a steeply discounted price, and these doctors' offices and hospitals and so on were getting the full price from Medicare. How did the pharmaceutical companies make money?
Well, they made money because who wouldn't want to become a millionaire by buying your product? The doctors were not only billing, and by the way, I should say this goes on in all the pharmaceuticals. We've seen $3 billion settlements of cases, one last week from GlaxoSmithKline. We've seen Pfizer pay $2.5 billion settlement for this type of thing. But sort of business as usual is to take all these doctors on wonderful resort vacations and to wine and dine them and to convince them and persuade them, I guess they would say, to prescribe these drugs off-label in ways that are not approved by the FDA. And oftentimes they prescribe them at higher doses, which a doctor can do, but it's illegal for a company to promote it in that way. And so, you know, you have to wonder, since about half of Americans, 150 million of us, are on prescription drugs, which ones have been prescribed to us because they really are good for us, and which ones have been prescribed to us because our doctor made a dime or got a nice dinner out of it. I now ask my doctors before they prescribe something to my children if they, you know, take samples from a pharmaceutical or if they've gone on trips. I have to distinguish, though, between pill samples and between injectables like Procrit, because injectables like chemotherapy or Procrit are done in a doctor's office, so he can buy these drugs at wholesale and then bill at retail. And pills, on the other hand, are usually gotten at the pharmacy by the consumer themselves. So there's a big difference between the spread, I guess, one a doctor can make on these two different forms of drugs.
We're talking to Kathleen Sharp about the book Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. Tell us what you mean by the term off-label and how Procrit came to be prescribed both for off-label uses and at much higher doses than that for which it was approved, to the extent that it was approved, and what Johnson & Johnson's role was in those two things.
Well, off-label simply means that the FDA has not approved the drug except for what's on the label. In other words, if the FDA approved it at 30,000 units, then that is the way the company can promote the drug. But in the case of Procrit, they were promoting it at 40,000 units and even in some cases 50 and 60,000 units, which was not approved. And this was, you know, this was where the crime sort of happened. And it also, I should say, is where, you know, the patients were put at enormous risk. I mean, if you can imagine getting this, what essentially is an overdose, and as you pointed out, the gentleman in the beginning of my book, without his consent, was given a large dose of a drug that he really didn't need, Procrit. And when he comes home, he and his wife are talking, and they're very happy to be back together again with Jim being out of the hospital until suddenly he begins coughing up blood, and blood is coming out of his nose and his mouth, and he's hacking, and actual pieces of tumor are coming up. His blood had been so thickened by this drug that he literally choked on his own, you know, drowned in his own blood. And that's a horrific way to die. But these two companies, Amgen and Johnson & Johnson, both sort of gunned the doses in order to compete against each other and gain a larger market share of what was a very lucrative market.
And so what they did was basically they sent their sales reps into the field, and they would pay, these sales reps would pay doctors to go on their rounds with them. They would look at patient files and do all sorts of things that one would think would be completely against the rules, if not the laws, of hospitals.
Well, it's certainly against the ethics, and I think that's why we have HIPAA, which is supposed to keep patient files and charts confidential. But, you know, I have to say that Dean McClellan, for one, the rep and other character in this story who lives in Arizona, he didn't quite understand how illegal all of this was. When his boss told him to enroll doctors into what was a false or phony marketing study, he did what he was told. And when the doctor was too busy to select the patients himself, Dean actually sat in the back office and went through patient charts and selected cancer patients who he thought would be ideal for this marketing study. And they received high doses of Procrit without informed consent, and Dean kept track of them in his homemade little charts that he made. But what he didn't notice is that three of the five people, approximately, were dying and disappearing. And, even now today, we've talked about this so much, he really rues the fact that he ever did that, but at the time it seemed like he was being the good soldier.
I mean, it really amounts to clinical trials that are administered by salesmen.
Well, exactly, and that's exactly what these companies do. And even more astounding is that these trials are led by doctors who are getting money from Amgen or Johnson & Johnson, and all of the other doctors participating in that are also paid by these companies. And then the Journal of Clinical Oncology or other very upstanding, respected medical journals are printing these studies. And when you read them carefully, you see, oh, my God, the numbers don't add up. This doesn't make sense. And yet these were the studies that Dean McClellan and Mark Duxbury would slap down on the doctor's desk and say, see, we've tested this. The high dose is excellent for your patients. And how many vials do you want, doc? And that's how these guys slowly but surely got these drugs up to $60 billion, a level that was, at one point, the most reimbursed Medicare drug ever.
And these studies were printed in respected journals? Those mistakes were not caught? They seem so huge.
It does seem huge, and it caused quite a stir that a few years ago the journals began to realize, wow, we better look at this a little bit more closely and have our authors and the doctors and physicians who submit these studies reveal all of their conflicts of interest. And, of course, almost every study that we see printed has been funded by the pharmaceutical companies. So it sort of behooves us to look at why this is. Is there not enough money for independent research? How about scientists that do not take drug money? Can they look at a drug and in an unbiased way and report truthfully on what the results, the risks and benefits are? We don't have a lot of that going on in this country, unfortunately.
Do you have a sense of how many people died or were harmed by these illegal uses of Procrit?
Well, this is a tricky question. The simple answer is that Mark Duxbury estimated about 500,000 people died. But the more nuanced answer is that when you have chemotherapy patients on a drug, they're already, ill from cancer. And so how many of those people died from cancer and how many of them died from the overdose of the drug? One of the horrific things that the FDA found out too late is that this drug not only multiplies your red blood cells, but it multiplies your cancer cells. So that people who were on chemotherapy who had a hope of living actually died much quicker on this drug than they would have if they'd taken a placebo. And so you can imagine all the heartbreak of people losing their mother or their wife or their sister because this drug was not adequately tested nor given at its prescribed approved levels.
We're talking to Kathleen Sharp about the book Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. So let's go back to the story of Mark Duxbury. He was fired from his job on trumped-up charges, but it was pretty clear that it was because he was bringing up serious issues about the company's practices. Tell us that whole story.
Well, Mark saw what was happening with this the blood feud between Amgen and J&J with a patient caught in the middle. He saw that there were dirty deals being done on both sides. And when he began to speak up and tell his bosses, he was rocking the boat. And so there's this wonderful chapter in the book, I think, called Gaslighting. And that's what his corporate bosses would do to him. They would ring him out for doing something that they had already asked him to do. For example, he was told to spend $10,000 on this wonderful cancer event, Relay for Life, they called it, in which they would convince hospitals to pass out free goodie bags full of, you know, ProCrit emblazoned logos and T-shirts and whatever else were in these bags. And Mark would have a big luncheon for all the participants in this relay. And he spent the $10,000, as he was asked to do, but then he was berated and chastised for doing so. And this whole idea of gaslighting comes from the old film noir of the same name, Gaslight, in which a man begins to fool his young, pretty wife, who happened to inherit a lot of money, and he tries to drive her crazy so that he can take over her house. The same thing happened with Mark. His bosses tried to drive him crazy, and they succeeded in a weird way. He had a nervous breakdown. He had to take a 6-month leave of absence, and he was given various antidepressants and mood drugs that made his situation even worse. He started hallucinating. He heard people berating him. He heard noises, and he saw the lights go up and down. And he just crumbled and cracked. But at some point, you know, here's the thing about whistleblowers. They are different than you and I. He had something inside of him, some gumption that made him stronger, and he got himself up off the floor and went back to work and redoubled his efforts to sort of make things right.
He eventually became a legal investigator for a law firm that was bringing suits against pharmaceutical companies. And he eventually brought a suit against his former employer. Tell us that whole story.
Well, after Mark had his little nervous breakdown, and once he was fired on trumped-up charges, he spent many years trying to figure out how he could make things right. He kept reading these studies that we mentioned earlier that didn't make sense, with a number of people disappearing in the studies or people mysteriously dying. And first he thought, oh, I'll do a shareholder fraud suit. And this was during the time of Enron's implosion, when people were suing companies for not reporting everything to shareholders. And Mark's theory was that Johnson & Johnson had not reported their rivalry with Amgen, and the two were suing each other in private courts. So that suit never did get far. He had tried to file something with the SEC. He tried to alert various congressmen and senators, but everyone turned a blind eye and a deaf ear to him. So while he's looking for jobs, you know, he's being turned down by Home Depot, he's delivering pies for Pizza Hut, and he walks into an attorney's house or an attorney's office one day in Seattle. And that attorney is suing about 40 pharmaceuticals for this inflated price scheme. It was like, you know, wonderful serendipity that he would walk into an office that desperately needed his knowledge about pharmaceutical industry. So Mark suddenly had another great job. You know, he could wear his nice suits again and his silk ties, and he had an office with a real coffee mug, you know, and free coffee. He was so delighted to be of service again. And it just turns out that that attorney also agreed to represent Mark in his whistleblowing case. And Mark had never heard of the False Claims Act before, but that is the law that whistleblowers use to sue people that they, or mostly corporations that they see, are gaming the federal government and taxpayers. And that's what happened in about 2003. Mark and his good buddy Dean McClellan joined, linked hands, and they filed this whistleblowing suit against Johnson & Johnson, alleging a number of things, which we can go into.
Well, and the participation of Dean McClellan came when he was later also fired, and he was asked to give back all of his files. And it's just, there's an amazing passage in the book where he is talking about, where you're talking about all the files that he has, and for whatever compulsive, I don't know what this guy was like, but for whatever his compulsive reasons, he'd kept every single piece of paper and had 2 storage sheds in his garage and then some, totally filled with boxes. He had to give them all back. And so they did this amazing feat of copying them all and then rebinding them and giving them all back, which led to their ability to file these cases. But anyway, tell us what these suits were about.
Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful scene. And actually, Dean was sort of the defense lawyer's nightmare and the journalist's dream come true. You know, he saved every photo he'd taken on these wonderful resort trips and every doctor's document he'd given showing all the money that Johnson & Johnson had given to doctors and different services and fees. So, you know, I just couldn't believe it when Dean actually took me into his storage sheds and I saw 15,000 documents and photos. And that's how I was able to sort of recreate in this very novelistic way the scenes and the characters and the atmosphere. And without those pieces of paper, I don't think I would have been able to, you know, to write such a, what I hope is a compelling story. But, you know, Dean had always kept in touch with his good friend Mark Duxbury. And while Mark was, after he was fired, he was sort of falling apart and disintegrating, and he couldn't find another decent paying job. He couldn't keep his house. You know, he couldn't keep his family together. And yet Dean always was his friend. And Dean himself was starting to be pushed out because Johnson & Johnson suspected that Dean was participating in Mark's whistleblowing operation. And yet the two men were able to sort of mend their ways. They had many disagreements over the years about whether or not Johnson & Johnson would actually do what it was doing, and Dean refused to believe it. He was kind of the guy who went along with the herd, you know, who looked the other way when you saw a Penn State coach abusing some young child. You know, it's so easy for us to not step forward, and Dean was that kind of guy, whereas Mark was totally the opposite. But they had such a tight relationship, and they had shared so much on the medicine road, as I call it, that they were able to, you know, go back to their affection for one another and kind of fix their relationship. And boy, once they did, they totally dedicated everything they had, documents, knowledge, brain power, creativity, to help make their case pretty airtight. And they became, you know, indeed the first people to blow the whistle on Procrit.
What did they allege in their lawsuit?
Well, in the original lawsuit, they alleged several things. One was that Johnson & Johnson taught its reps how to market the spread. In other words, they used the high sticker price as the reported price of the drug while selling the drug at a low discount rate. Now, with Medicare and Medicaid, the law says that pharmaceuticals have to pay or have to sell the drugs at the low rate. But instead, we learn that from these two reps and from the documents that we're getting stuck with the high rate. So that was one sort of cause, AWP, which is the average wholesale price, the inflated price. Another was the off-label claim that they were being taught how to illegally sell and promote drugs at unapproved levels. And also, I should say, for unapproved treatments. You know, in one chapter of this book, I describe these beautiful, lush commercials that Johnson & Johnson made. You know, they spent something like $150 million on advertising for this and a few other drugs. And one of these commercials was an award-winning thing on Procrit. And you look at it and you see these, you know, young women with beautiful, lush hair. They're not cancer patients by any means. And you're thinking, oh, if I get a shot of Procrit, maybe I too can be energetic and not feel the fatigue that I feel. And so that was another sort of off-label example, and one that the FDA eventually came down on Johnson & Johnson for doing. So there was also an overfill. These vials are supposed to hold only a certain amount of drug, but Johnson & Johnson would fill the drug, those vials, with more drugs so that the doctors could then bill for the lower amount of drug, but actually use the higher amount and bill the patients for the higher amount. So there's just so many ways to game the system, but Mark and Dean in their lawsuit alleged three or four.
And so what happened?
Well, what happened is that most of these cases are filed in Boston, which is supposed to be a very consumer-friendly federal district court. It's amazing how many whistleblowing cases, by the way, are kind of stuck there right now. But what happened is that it went before Judge Zobel, the case, and Mark Duxbury and his wonderful attorney, Jan Schlickman, who some of your listeners may remember from A Civil Action, which is another great book that was turned into a movie in which John Travolta played Jan Schlickman. So eventually, Mark found Jan Schlickman, a real crusading lawyer, to take on his case. And in 2007, Jan Schlickman appears before the judge and faces Johnson & Johnson's very formidable legal team. These guys work in Washington, D.C. at a firm called Covington & Burling. And the two sort of duke it out verbally. And the judge, shockingly, dismisses the case. And she claims that Mark was not the first man to blow the whistle on this national fraud. But she falsely says that someone else does. Now, when I say falsely, I mean that she was incorrect. Eventually, 2 years later, an appeals court overturns that ruling and reinstates the case, which is a huge victory for Jan and Dean and Mark. So now, here we are, almost 8, 9 years later, and the case has still not gone to trial. It still hasn't had its day in court, although I must say that I'm going back to Boston on December 13th when the judge has called before her the two sides, Johnson & Johnson and Duxbury, and hopefully we'll have a trial date soon.
What has been the Department of Justice's stand on this whole case?
Oh, that's a great question. The Department of Justice is supposed to be the big cop in the land, right? And if somebody blows the whistle and notifies the Department of Justice that they believe fraud is going on, the Department of Justice must investigate. Well, it usually, if they find good reason, they will intervene, and then what happens is that quickly the pharmaceutical company will settle. If they don't settle, then what happens is, oh boy, all kinds of nasty stuff comes out in trial, and it really embarrasses the pharmaceutical. So once the Department of Justice intervenes in a case, taxpayers are bound to get their money back. But for some mysterious reason, the Department of Justice has not intervened in this case, even though there's plenty of evidence that the drug has been dangerous, that it was promoted off-label, that all kinds of things were done to, bill the government in false ways. And some people wonder why this is. It could be because the Department of Justice is undermanned, it's overwhelmed by all these cases. Something like 90% of all government fraud cases now relate to healthcare and pharmaceuticals. But then there's another theory, and that theory is that the head of the Department of Justice, Eric Holder, formerly worked for Covington and Burling, the very same company that is now defending Johnson & Johnson. So what you see in this book, Blood Feud, is sort of the revolving door between the pharmaceutical industry and government, where the U.S. Attorney General keeps going back, recycling back to government, and then going back into private practice defending pharmaceutical companies. This has happened several times with Eric Holder and with other members of his team. So that's another theory that we really have to look at, too.
Indeed, that is absolutely shocking. This whole lawsuit began under the Bush administration, is now under the Obama administration. It doesn't seem like there's really a very big difference in terms of what whistleblowers can expect in terms of protection and justice.
No, it doesn't, and that's a very sad comment. And perhaps other people, have other theories as to why that is, but I think what this goes to the heart of is the huge influence of corporate money in our political system, our justice system, our regulatory system. Until we have clean money campaigns, I don't see how there can be sort of an even playing field among businesses and consumers, or just plain old citizens. It's just shocking to me because I ran into it time and time again in Washington, D.C., and I even asked several members of the FDA if they would take Procrit. And this was back in 2007 and 2008, and without hesitation, they said no. And yet, here they are, you know, allowing the drug to be out in the marketplace, and here Medicare is paying for it, and here Congress is hearing about these sharp practices. I mean, I went back and I listened to congressional hearings where both Amgen and J&J were trying to explain why they had these wonderful lush commercials on TV or why they were promoting off-label use. And still, there's no accountability for these companies. And I think it goes back to money.
Well, it's a sign of our times, I think, that Johnson & Johnson, which once had a, I think, pretty well-earned reputation for being a solid and honest company and admitting its mistakes and so on, is now just any old greedy company.
Well, yeah, that's true. And, you know, maybe some of us remember during the mid-80s when there was a Tylenol scare, and I think six people died from capsules that were actually poison in the Tylenol bottles. And Johnson & Johnson was very stand-up about it. You know, they immediately recalled 31 bottles of Tylenol, and they came up with this tamper-proof medicine top, and they kept in touch, you know, through press conferences with the public to try and assure them that all was right, and they fixed the problem. But here, when you have thousands of more people at risk and a lot more money, they've been oddly silent, and that was really kind of shocking to me that they wouldn't, you know, step forward and sort of help shape this book. You know, they were kind of the gold standard of corporate accountability, and I don't think you can say that now. And then when I look at why that could be, you know, I see the pressure that all of these publicly traded companies are under with, you know, to make ever higher quarterly earnings and to pump that stock up and to please the shareholders and the investors who tend to be huge hedge fund people or certainly not the average mom and dad. But they, too, are under pressure to generate more income and ever more money. And this whole system just seems out of whack, especially when it's not serving the patients or the consumers.
I think there's an irony which really needs to be brought out in all of this, which is that you have among what might be called a conservative establishment a very anti-government waste faction that is also pro-corporate. But it's precisely the corporate system that is creating all this government waste by defrauding the public.
Well, the government's been very good to corporations, so it's kind of ironic that there is this anti or small government mentality out there. And I think if people would sit down and really look at it on a personal basis, you know, is that drug you're taking, you think, has that been well tested? Is that safe? Or has the corporation sort of urged it to be on the fast track of approval and maybe played a little fast and loose with some of the testing? Do you feel like your water's cleaner or that your food is safer? I don't think that this pro-business government style of governing really serves everyone, including businesses. I think it hurts businesses because, let's face it, they don't have a sterling reputation right now, and there's a good reason why.
You have suggested so far two major remedies to the kinds of problems that this book brings out. And I think one of the strengths of this book, besides the fact that it is a page-turner that you can't even put down, is that it points far beyond the story. It points to the much larger issues. And I think you've suggested two solutions, one of them being getting money out of politics, and the other is a single-payer system. And if we were to do these things, how do you think they would reform the lives of patients, for example, who have cancer, who have blood problems and go to doctors and go into the hospital?
Well, I think that we would spend a lot less time and money and energy on insurance matters and on paper filing. A lot of people consider single payer to be something akin to socialism, but I think it's important to point out that You still have private doctors. You still go to clinics or hospitals. It's just that you don't have to pay 2% to every little middleman who's in the, you know, in this huge anaconda-sized pipeline. There are so many players in the private healthcare system. There's the pharmacy. There's the HMO. There's the doctor. There's the pharmaceutical company. There's the drug rep and all the consultants and people that we don't even see in this shadow world. And each one of them take a percent. And when you look at how much money, it's something like 16% of our gross national product is wrapped up in healthcare, compared to maybe 6% in Japan or other countries. It just, you know, we're driving ourselves crazy with this privatized healthcare. And then there's also sort of the moral and ethical issue of whether or not somebody should make a nickel off the disease of a child or, of, you know, your grandmother. That just doesn't seem right. And I just think it'd be, everyone would be much better served if we were to go to a simple sort of single-payer system, and our costs would be lower.
There is an argument to be made for pharmaceutical companies being private businesses and spending large amounts of venture capital to develop drugs. And, I mean, we had a doctor on this program recently who's devoted his life to working with AIDS patients, and I asked him after we got off the air, I said, what do you think about this? And he said, well, it's not great, but it does get a lot of new drugs out there. It seems like making a profit is not necessarily the problem. It's the lack of regulation so that there's not a balanced system now. It seems like you could have some people making money off developing new drugs if there were really strong regulation and a partnership between the people who are developing the drugs and the regulators that was understood.
Absolutely. And, I need to probably clarify it. I'm not at all against people making a profit on services or goods. I think that's crucial. And I am a business reporter after all. But what I object to is, let's just take the case of EPO. This was taxpayer, the invention of EPO, the discovery of it, was subsidized by taxpayers for many, many years through the National Institute of Health, which put, you know, tons of money into it. It was also protected by an orphan law, which protected the drug from, and the company, from any outside competition. There were many, many bills and many measures, public measures, taxpayer-funded measures, that protected and helped develop this drug, so much so that the inventor, Eugene Goldwasser, firmly believed that some of the profits from this drug should go back to the taxpayers. And this is what, you know, is so interesting, because a lot of the pharmaceutical companies say, oh, we need to charge high prices because of our research and development. But they don't spend that much money on research and development. They spend a lot more money on marketing, on commercials, on off-label promotion, and other things. So that's cluing you into how innovative these companies are. They really aren't. And I should also point out that Amgen, who, of course, kind of patented or licensed this drug, had a sort of copycat drug. First there was Epigen, which went toe-to-toe against Procrit. But then Amgen invented another drug just by tweaking a little molecule, and that was Aranesp. And it was basically the same anti-anemia blood booster, but it could now go into the cancer market because of the licensing that it had. So rather than inventing a whole new drug to really cure a disease, it just came up, you know, by tweaking one little molecule with another curative treatment. And so what you had is, you know, three or four of these drugs. It didn't quite work for a disease that never existed. And if you look around today, you see all these very expensive cancer drugs, $100,000 a year, and they're going up against another, you know, $100,000 a year drug, and you have to wonder, how is this serving the overall health of Americans?
How did you, Kathleen, get involved with this story and the very extensive interviews you did with Mark Duxbury and Dean McClellan?
Well, that's a great story because Mark called me out of the blue in 2004, and he had seen some of my other work, and he'd been trying to alert the media to this, what he thought was a very important story. But nobody had picked up on his story, and I really didn't find it very credible. I mean, I thought, my God, you know, Johnson & Johnson? How could they be doing something like this? But Mark kept calling, you know, every 3 months over several years, and he was spoon-feeding me sort of the ABCs of pharmacology 101, and I began to understand how the industry worked and how secretive it was. But I still didn't get it, really, until 2007, when I realized that both the FDA and Congress were holding public meetings on both the dangers of the drug and the sharp marketing practices of the makers. And that's when I, you know, emptied my savings account and flew to Washington, D.C., and saw firsthand this unfolding scandal right before my eyes. And I thought, wow, you know, here's a great way to tell this huge, you know, sweeping story through the eyes of a star salesman. And Mark and I agreed to work hand in hand for the next 2 or 3 years, as did Jan Schlickman and Dean. And I was really quite lucky in that way because all four of the guys were extremely helpful no matter how many times I asked the same question. Believe me, I did several times.
What are your hopes for this book?
I'm hoping that Mark's goal, which is to let everybody know about it, will be accomplished, and also that someone will be held accountable for these egregious practices, and that somehow we can bring about a healthier system for all Americans where you're not worried about whether or not this drug is going, you know, whether you know all about the risks and the benefits or if there's something else happening behind those closed doors. I would love it if this would bring about a healthier medical system here in the U.S., and if somebody were to be held accountable, or a few people, for this whole tale.
It would be interesting if this book were also made into a movie. It certainly is vivid enough just in the way you've written it.
Yeah, it's been lovely. There's been some interest in that, so we'll see what happens.
Kathleen Sharp is the author of Blood Feud, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. She is a journalist who writes for the New York Times and many other publications. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much. I've loved this.